This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Jane and Sarika. Thanks for your support, friends. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with our episode.
He was one of the kindest, most gentle, loving, caring people I knew. He helped me tremendously. He helped me with my career. He helped me with my creativity, with all of those sorts of things. And he also sexually abused me for 7 years.
The HBO documentary everyone's talking about, or suing over, as the case may be, Leaving Neverland, premiered a couple days ago, and Piper Weiss returns to talk about the King of Pop's garden variety, grooming, and predation. Later, I interview Sky Borgman, director of Abducted in Plain Sight, another case that had the audience side-eyeing the parents, rightly or wrongly. I don't have the stomach to make a pun about any of Michael Jackson's album titles, so without further ado, it's The Blotter Presents, episode 87. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, devoted to the principle that crime is bad, but some of the material about crime can be pretty good. Today, I am joined once again by a guest who is now getting her mail delivered here at Blotter Presents HQ, Piper Weiss. Piper, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We have both watched both installments of Leaving Neverland. So let's get into it in our most wanted section. Leaving Neverland, of course, the two-part, four-hour documentary that, as you're listening to this, has already aired in its entirety on HBO. We were lucky enough, I guess, is the word, to have screeners of this. Yeah. Here is the case file. Rumors that Michael Jackson had inappropriate relationships with children had dogged him since the 1980s. But when he bought off an accuser in the early 90s, then emerged from a criminal trial unscathed in the aughts, it seemed like we'd all just have to accept legally that he was merely weird and not a monster. Dan Reed's Leaving Neverland centers the testimony of two of Jackson's alleged targets, Wade Robson and Jimmy Safechuck, and turns the idea that Jackson was a naive with no sexual designs on his, quote, special friends, inside out. Okay, before we get into this, we do have some clips. We don't have anything that is too detailed comparatively for this documentary, which is quite detailed as to what Jackson did to these two now men. But these accounts will still be difficult for some people. So let's just do a summary review up top. Then we'll get into it. The filmmaking on this for me is like a B minus, but I think it is important testimony to be heard. It is deeply affecting and deeply sad, but it's difficult. It's very difficult material. Piper, what is your capsule review so that if people feel that they can't continue, they can just decide whether this is something that they can handle or should bother with?
Yeah, I mean, it's very real. It's very real. It's very raw. I think it is a really important testimony. I think it touches on aspects of molestation that we're just now starting to talk about, including what it means to process it years later, and also, the reactions from family members and the questions we always have about how could something like this happen, which are really important questions that the film addresses. I agree that it is a B minus in terms of filmmaking, but there are certain visuals that are actually like really important in terms of like access to Neverland Ranch images that clearly match descriptions that the subjects are describing that I don't think I've seen anywhere else.
Yeah, and there are some facts materials. Well, we'll get into it. But if you are just looking for, you know, whether you should watch this, yes, I think you should. But if you feel that you will find it too difficult, you should take care of yourself.
Yeah.
And probably shut off this podcast now. So in terms of the filmmaking, I had a couple of issues with it. This is something that other reviews have mentioned, but there are a lot of overhead drone shots. There's a lot of pointed strings on the score that underline how you're supposed to feel, which how else should you feel about this wretched account? It seems a little unfocused at times. There is a section regarding Wade Robson's family and specifically his father and his father's struggles with mental illness that
yes.
I didn't think it was irrelevant or uninteresting, but it was perhaps it went on too long. And I must say that unless you have absolutely no choice, I must object to anyone using footage of Matt Lauer interrogating any story of this type or really anything else. Fuck him.
Well put. That went over my head, but that is exactly right. That was
twice
choice.
It happened that it's like, yep. I understand that if absolutely nobody else took on this interview, you may just have to hold your nose and do it to locate us contemporaneously in coverage of a case, but with particularly a case of sexual abuse or sexual assault, it's just not. Find some footage with Katie Couric instead, which they also used.
Yeah.
So that was troublesome. However, this director, Dan Reed, has directed two other things that I've seen on HBO, one on the Charlie Hebdo attacks and one called Terror at the Mall. And I think that his priority is to go for a visceral reaction. He's not so interested, I think, in traditional formal structures, which is fine, and he is successful, particularly in the Charlie Hebdo documentary, at making you feel like you're there for good or ill. And spoiler, it's never for good.
Yeah.
But in something like this, there was just something about it that was like, between how long it was and how just devastating the stories were, I felt like perhaps more of a filmmaker structural touch was called for, just to give us a little bit of relief occasionally. But if the point is to just remind us that there has been no relief for these men, then message received.
Yes. I mean, this is not, the caliber of like the 5-part OJ documentary that like contextualizes that case and OJ Simpson as a figure in like, you know, in reference to America and race in America. Like, I think there's a lot that you could kind of have pulled apart with Michael Jackson as a figure and how polarizing he is in this country and what he meant to children and what he means to so many different people and kind of have made a larger documentary around that. But I don't think, and this is not that, but I don't think that it makes this documentary any less important. It's just really specific in terms of what it's getting at.
Yeah, I didn't have an issue with that. I did read some reviews that suggested that the fact that the question of race was never really touched on or broached by this documentary is a failing of it. And my feeling is, if this aspect of Jackson is what you're focusing on, you have to be like religious about like staying on topic.
Yes.
Or
yes.
It's a 10-part, and I'm not saying I wouldn't watch a 10-part MJ Made in America.
I sure would.
Yeah. I absolutely would, because that's just a huge, like, vast series of topics that, you know, would take 10 or 12 hours or longer to do. But this is not that, and is not trying to be that.
That's true.
So there are things that sometimes you're like, well, why isn't this mentioned and why isn't that mentioned? And I did feel that there was a jump in part two. Like, once you're in part two and these boys, Jimmy and Wade, are becoming teenagers and men and more independent and have been replaced in Jackson's predatory affections, there's an elliptical quality where the time is going forward, and I sort of felt a little bit disoriented in terms of where we were in their stories, in Jimmy's and Wade's stories, and what they were doing and how they were feeling. But
yes,
you know, maybe that's just not something that kind of came out in the interviews.
I do feel like a lot does come out in the interviews that I hadn't heard as public statements from people who have been victims of child abuse or child molestation in that way. I mean, there were certain aspects that the way, and we can get into it later, but like the way they talked about it was really riveting to me, and it rang really true, and yet it was like a different way of talking about these kinds of dynamics than I had heard before. I thought that, yes, there was an honesty to it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, yes, let's put a pin in that for right now. First, I want to play clip two, and this is I believe Jimmy sort of, or James, I don't think he's called Jimmy anymore, sort of trying to explain that you can't explain how famous Michael Jackson was. And then, you know, there is this person like being friends with him. So here's clip two.
How do you explain Michael Jackson? He's larger than life. There's no stars like that now, that kind of mega star. And everybody wanted to meet Michael or be with Michael. He was quiet and he laughed a lot at me and he's giggly. The stand-in, we became kind of buddies. And I looked at him and I said, oh, we're the luckiest boys in the world.
That snort at the end.
Yeah.
There is a lot of time devoted in these interviews to explaining, which I think is a good thing, to explaining the grooming and the normalizing of behavior that is not normal for most adults, and the ability of Michael Jackson to manipulate his fame, not just because he's famous, but all the secondary aspects of that he doesn't have a lot of friends, that he's very isolated, that nobody understands him, that he didn't have a childhood. And I think the way that this is repeated and reframed so many times is a good thing, because I think it can't be overstated how good and expert sexual predators are at doing this to children and to entire families, which we have seen in the R. Kelly documentary, which we have seen which we heard in The Keepers from a couple years ago, which you hear in like every single instance of this.
And how the grooming process isn't just, you know, focused on the child, but also on the family members and ingratiating yourself into them and their world so that they trust you more than anyone. I mean, that's the chilling part too, that it breaks down your system of protections if you're a child that's vulnerable to this.
Yeah, because you're being seduced. I mean, this is something that comes up in Abducted in Plain Sight as well. I talk a little bit in that with the in my interview with Sky Borgman, the director, which is coming up in a section after this, that, you know, the predator is obliged to prey on the whole family. Like, in order to circle one away from the herd, he has to manipulate the entire herd to an extent. So that a lot of it feels like, in the interviews, it feels like they are rationalizing it to themselves, even though, like, I don't need this rationalized to me, that you were preyed on. You were a child. But I think it's still worthwhile, that sort of like accretion of these details that are also the same between the two cases.
Yes. Almost identical.
Yeah. And I didn't find that suspicious. Apparently the pro Michael Jackson bots in various comment sections feel that that's damning as to their lying. No. I'm like,
the opposite.
Yeah. Or, you know, the guy had kinks that were consistent.
Completely. I mean,
gross.
Completely. And there's consistency in the way that their mothers kind of reacted to Michael Jackson. I mean, there are consistencies that are not coincidental and not contrived. You know, they couldn't be for that reason, you know?
Yeah. Well, you do have like one mom who's a little bit more of a stage mom, and then another mom who, and Jackson reads each of them separately and plays into what they need him to be in the situation. So I think Wade's mom is tempted with the promise of, you know, work and fame for Wade, and secondarily for herself. And
independence for herself, ironically.
Right. And then, and that whole story, good God. But then James's mom is sort of suckered into mothering.
Yes.
Michael Jackson. And we hear a little bit of that in clip three.
Now that I look back on it, it's almost like an audition for him. He sends his film crew out.
He didn't explain it. I just figured he's far away. This is part of how he can be with people. And he made it clear that he was very lonely. He didn't have any friends.
I mean, I have to say, like, you know, I think my feeling about all of this as of Michael Jackson's death almost 10 years ago is that he had done something.
Yeah.
But he never had a chance to be anything but what he was. Not that I was excusing these acts, or not that he wasn't responsible for these acts. But I feel like he knew that is how we felt all along, and that he leveraged that, you know, in these situations as well, that he had this dreadful upbringing Mm-hmm. And he, like, I still feel he never had a chance to be a functioning adult. But
no, he's clearly like a deeply stunted, you know, tortured soul who has so much money that he melted, you know, I mean, like,
yeah,
psychologically and physically.
But I also feel that there were functional adults around him,
yep,
for decades who must have known that this was happening, but it was easier or more lucrative to avert their eyes. In clip four, we hear a little bit about how Michael Jackson also manages to use someone's faith against them.
I came to feel like he was one of my sons by how he behaved. I loved him. He was a son I started to take care for. He would spend the night, I'd wash his clothes. At the time when I was thinking about, should we get Jimmy in commercials, I prayed to the Lord that if this is good for Jimmy, open the doors for him and let this happen. And if it's not, don't let it happen. Well, of course, the doors opened so quickly. And then when Michael would come to our house, I told this story to Michael about how I prayed about this before it happened. Well, Michael tells me, I prayed too. I prayed that I could have a friend. And then I met Jimmy. Well, to me, the two prayers came together, and this was a friendship that was meant to be.
Which is exactly what he wanted you to believe. What was your feeling about what the film wanted us to feel about the mothers? Does that make any sense?
It was interesting the way the mothers are portrayed, because there is this feeling, especially with Jimmy's mother, that they don't fully get the extent of what happened to their children. There's, you know, the victims seem to kind of like be grappling with it, and in some ways like coming out on the other end. While it doesn't, I didn't get the sense that the mothers have done like directly looking in the eye of what happened and like processing it. And that could just be, you know, the editing, you know, or just that they're kind of secondary characters that we don't see as much from, but, you know, even just like the way they contextualize some of this stuff, I still get the sense that Jimmy's mother has these like maternal feelings for Michael Jackson, and that she's as conflicted as her son is, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's entirely possible that they have not, that they were willing to, or felt, you know, felt that they should elide some of what actually happened to them, yeah, like physically for their moms. But when you compare, yes, that to their siblings' reactions, which like Wade's brother Shane and his sister Chantel,
yeah,
who are, you know, in tears at various times, and Shane at one point is trying to describe, knowing what he knows now, apparently while trying not to throw up. Like, I mean, their response is much more viscerally shocked and disgusted and infuriated, and the mothers do seem rather more placid and accepting in a way that, I mean, now it's all out, and if they've watched this, now they know. But I That's think you're right. Right, that, you know, and there is definitely this sense that even if there was an attempt to tell them exactly what happened, that they couldn't hear it fully.
Yes. Yes. There's like a kind of like intentional blindness that comes across with both of the mothers. Yeah, it's a little bit chilling. You know, I mean, especially when you find out the gifts that the families were getting that coincided with their children's testimony on behalf of Michael Jackson, you know, and that the mothers are still processing the kind of quote unquote coincidental nature of that.
Yeah. And that they're on tour together and they're, you know, the whole family is in the hotel.
Yep.
But the boy is with Michael in his room.
Yep.
And the family's hotel room is getting progressively further and further away from the room that Michael is sharing with the boy.
Yep.
And they're like, oh, well, but they said it was the only suite available. So we're two floors away at the other end of the hotel. Like, uh-huh. And then you go up at bedtime and you retrieve your child. Like, there's absolutely no way that my mother would have permitted any of this. Like, if I wanted to stay at my grandma's for 2 weeks instead of one, my mother was like, no, that's too much sugar cereal. This, forget it. Barb would have raised absolute hell and called Interpol. But, you know, as tempting.
I see how this happens. Like, I'm not a mother, but I have been in situations, not obviously like this, but where my family has been more permissive with someone. I mean, Michael Jackson had two things, you know, quote unquote, going for him. One was that he is the most famous person in the world.
Right.
And celebrity is intoxicating because it's power and money.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is that he acted like a child. So I think that he seemed harmless because he seemed so childlike in nature. Like, I don't, even just as someone who kind of always believed these allegations, I could never imagine how far they went until I watched this documentary, because Michael Jackson to me seemed so naive.
Yeah. And did present, I'm sure purposefully, as this sexless, childlike entity. And you know, this is what I was about to say, like, it's tempting to be like, I can't believe these parents, but it's like, actually I can, because this is somebody who has years of experience and nothing else to think about a lot of the time,
right?
But gradually setting up these situations and very gradually turning the heat up on these little tadpoles so that, and frogs, so that nobody jumps out. And you hear a little bit about this normalization process in the clip we're about to hear, but it, you know, in the end, yes, maybe these parents should have been less starstruck or sympathetic, or, you know, however we want to blame them, but they were being set up by, you know, by a predator who, this is what they do. They set this up. So here's clip 5.
Spend a lot of time just in the hotel room with him. And the hotel rooms are, you know, the president's suites. So they're quite large. So there's lots of room to play, and you just grow closer. I remember we would fall asleep together, and then when I wake up, he would be in another room. And I would be hurt that he was in another room. And so I'd ask him to stay.
It seems like it was a natural thing that happened. My husband and I had to have said, yes, you can go sleep with Michael.
In Paris, he introduced me to masturbation. And that's how it started.
I mean, and on it goes. Like, gradually he turns the heat up, that he's suggesting that their parents don't want, and particularly their fathers, don't really love them as much or want what's best for them, that he wants them to come live with him, that he just keeps turning it up and I don't let the mothers off the hook, but I think we always have to remember that this was an unbelievably famous, unbelievably powerful, rich person who worked in a field that these boys aspired to. I know they were kids, but still.
Still.
Who is able to execute on this like predator playbook that he is working straight out of. So the responsibility in the end, the blame, like, how did this happen? Michael Jackson was a fucking monster. That's how.
Yeah.
And he did it to the parents too. Not, you know, would I have run it the same way if these were my kids? No, I'd like to say.
Yeah.
But we don't know.
There might be other parents out there that put the kibosh on it, and thankfully, you know, they're not a part of this documentary. You know, you don't know. That's one thing that's not totally clear in this documentary. You know, like, a few of the people that have made allegations outside of this documentary, but I wonder if there was like a broader scope of people that have had experiences with him. I wanted to know how far reaching it is, but maybe that's just also legally murky territory.
Well, and it's possible that people did take payouts and are honoring those agreements. It's possible that people are in denial. I strongly suspect that Macaulay Culkin, you know, that they weren't in bunk beds.
I hope I'm wrong too. You know, this also, have you been following the Bryan Singer case?
Yes. Ooh.
This also kind of, there's something about this that especially makes me think of that Atlantic article. Does a really great job of talking about the specific psychology of like boys who are victims of child molestation and like how they especially are like groomed in general for this like culture of silence and being strong and taking responsibility for the thing and not being a victim. And so in some ways it's really hard for them in adult life to kind of understand when they were the most vulnerable or powerless, you know, or to allow that something happened to them. And I think that you see a lot of that. And I think it's really brave of the, especially with Jimmy, the way he talks about it, he kind of grapples with it being almost a romantic relationship.
Yes.
Where he's falling in love, you know, and Wade Robson says it too, of like that they've fallen in love with this man. And so they're kind of like taking responsibility for what happened to them. And there's no right way to cope with something like this, so you know, but it's really powerful testimony that I hadn't really heard before, you know, just like that they somehow kind of saw it as first love.
Well, you know, but yeah, that there is this aspect of it that is grieving a breakup. And
yes.
I think the temptation in these situations, because they were not like it was not a meaningful, like consent was not meaningful, but the relationship was extremely meaningful to them. And the fact that Jackson leveraged that for his own felonious ends doesn't mean that those feelings weren't real on the other side. And
that's right.
I thought that the one thing that this documentary did that was extremely impressive was make room for those feelings of grief without pathologizing them as like, you know, yes, mm-hmm. it is a product of trauma, but it's also real. And I thought it was horrible to watch. They're still in pain. From being rejected by this monster.
Yes.
But I love that Leaving Neverland sort of lets them, like, supports them in those emotions. Here is a clip. I think this is Jimmy. Michael, like, arranged some sort of hand fasting type of marriage ceremony between them. I think James was 11. At the time that this occurred, he still has the ring. And he shows it to us in an interview, and he's sort of laboring through talking about what this meant. And it's clear that he's not sure what note to strike. But in the clip we're about to hear, he's talking about having been replaced in Michael's affections and then having nowhere to go with how that felt because, A, Michael Jackson had isolated him, and B, there's all this like secondary shame, the kind of shame that you, Piper, were talking about, but also this shame about sexuality that has nothing to do with these power dynamics, but really is visited on boys who are assaulted in this way. Anyway, here's the clip.
Michael's my like partner, and then he's gone, and then you're not close to anybody else. So it's like, then you're just alone and you can't talk to anybody about anything. So you just continue to be alone.
There's also another sequence that I didn't clip where Wade is talking about this feeling of having been just rejected, left behind, and how long he continued to love Michael Jackson, and that he still, like a part of him still feels that love, that, I mean, romance is not the right word, but like it's excruciating. It's excruciating to watch. They're still in terrible pain. And part of that pain is that they feel maybe like they're not allowed to miss this man. And that the movie sort of makes room for them to do that and doesn't judge them, I think is pretty great, even though it's, I mean, it's really terrible to watch. But this is something that you were talking about earlier, that this is not something that these stories and coverage of these cases tends to focus on or want to look at.
That's right. Yeah, I think... we tend to kind of be like, he's a monster, and kind of put pressure on everyone to kind of agree, even the victims. And for the victims, it is so much more complicated than that. And they feel, or you can feel somehow like, you know, a combination of foolish and grieving and confused about what your feelings were because they felt so real. And in some ways, you were just not only rejected, but lied to by the person that you trusted most. So it makes you question your own judgment. And then to still have the reverberations of all of those feelings years later, the fact that this just doesn't go away. And something we also, I mean, we learn from this documentary is that Michael didn't just emotionally haunt these men now. He physically haunted them every time he was under scrutiny, you know, for allegations. He would be contacting these people now in their 20s. They hadn't heard from him in years, and he'd be contacting them and suddenly calling them every day again to be like, you know, confidants with them. I mean, I think it's implied that he's allegedly like trying to get them to testify and just also have his back and not hop on the opposite bandwagon.
Well, and Wade and his family in particular are like, well, he'll, you know, never survive jail and we have to save him. And this need, this need to protect him and to prove that he's worthy of Michael Jackson's love still.
Yes.
That was this, you know, that this is how tumbled up everything gets for someone who has been through this, that there's also that like parental, that like need to please the partner and be like, I'm still worthy of your love and respect. And then this is Wade is sort of working through this for us in a voiceover while we're seeing him in his early 20s teaching very, very Michael Jacksonian moves to Justin Timberlake and other members of NSYNC. And the other thing for these guys is like Michael Jackson was everywhere. He was Michael Jackson.
That's right.
So it's not like you can ever sort of escape. Like you go to the supermarket to buy like bread and some string cheese and you're in the checkout line and there he is doing something wacko.
I mean, the other thing is that he remains really tied up in their careers. They're both like child performers, but as they get older and they have interests in the entertainment industry in other ways, he's kind of helping, whether in name only or sometimes in practice, like helping facilitate some of opportunities for them, but also weirdly misguiding them, you know. For like Jimmy, he's like, you don't need to go to college.
Yeah.
You can drop out of this like AP placement math class because, you know, I'll help you be in the film industry. You know, he shot films on Neverland Ranch.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Wade Robson's like, you know, reputation, he's an incredibly talented choreographer, but part of, you know, his reputation is that, you know, he was trained by Michael Jackson himself.
Yeah. Even though Michael's, when it really counted, like the whole family uproots and goes to the States on the understanding that Michael Jackson is going to provide for them.
Right.
No.
Nope.
Ugh. I mean, yeah, like it's really a lot. But if it does nothing else, Leaving Neverland, I think, first of all, we hear testimony of victims, and that's always worthwhile. Difficult, but worthwhile. But
there's so much to learn from them.
But there's also this patient listening that the film does and doesn't need to, you know, be quite so black and white. Sorry, but must there be so many Michael Jackson song titles that are fucking ruined now? Apparently there must. Yeah. Like even the word bad. Burnt.
Can't use it.
But yeah, the last clip, it's sort of long, but here is Wade Robson, who we haven't actually heard that much from in the discussion. This is in part two where he's sort of going on a little journey in this clip talking about how he wasn't ready to stand with Gavin Arviso and Jordy Chandler at the time, and I think he is carrying a lot of guilt about that. And then he's talking about how he still wasn't in a place where he saw his relationship with Michael Jackson as a negative and a like predator victim setup for a long time. So here's clip 7.
Yeah, like I can't imagine if I was Gavin or if I was Jordy at that time. You know, no justice being served and not being believed by so many people. For Gavin, I wish I was at a place where I could tell the truth and be a comrade with him. You know, stopping Michael and stopping a lot of other kids from being abused. I just wasn't ready. I wasn't able when I was 11 and when I was 22. And I remember feeling happy. For sure, that he was acquitted, that he wasn't going to jail. I didn't believe or understand that the sexual stuff that happened between Michael and I was abuse. I didn't feel like I was hurt by it, that it was anything bad that happened to me. At that point, it was, I loved Michael. Michael loved me. This was something that happened between us. That's it. But I still had absolutely no understanding that I was affected, or any feeling that I was affected negatively.
This is after a long sequence in which both of their wives have been detailing the ways in which they were, everything that they had stuffed about the aftermaths of these relationships had affected them and were clearly affecting them. And the wives are just kind of waiting for something to break for them. And Wade says at some point that he, you know, I have nothing to feel guilty about in terms of lying for Michael. And I agree that he doesn't, but it's clear that he does. And it's really, it's difficult. Like, they are still struggling to figure out where to put this thing that that was. And I think they have to figure out a new spot for it every day. And it's really quite a document, leaving Neverland. It's not a fun sit. I'm not going to tell you that. Take breaks, call people you love. But there is something about it that is compelling and, you know, very worthwhile in terms of the victims and their stories having like better dimension, for lack of a better term. So yeah, to say that I liked it is not accurate, clearly, but yeah, it was rough, but worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In the same way that watching testimony from the victims of Larry Nassar is worth every minute and just as difficult, but there's so much that we can like learn in terms of prevention and, you know, not pointing fingers and also like treating victims with respect and listening to what their experiences were, and how long it takes to process, sometimes a whole lifetime.
Anything else to add about this? Any recommended reading? I happen to be in the middle of an exhaustively researched Michael Jackson biography called Untouchable. That is, I think, a little too interested in proving that he was an excellent father, but otherwise is quite fascinating. Have you read anything that you think listeners should check out vis-a-vis Leaving Neverland or the case?
No, I think for me it would be looking at archival coverage of some of the early allegations against them and seeing how the media wrote about it then. And then just also side note, I was working at the New York Daily News when Michael Jackson died. And I remember it being an intense 24 hours where we were just on lockdown and working on the history of Michael Jackson and what he meant to people. And I just had to research a timeline of his life. And there are so many other aspects of his life that do weirdly play into this story, from, you know, his strange animal collection to like the building of Neverland Ranch and his obsession with it, to this very uncomfortable, very public relationships with Lisa Marie Presley and Debbie Rowe.
Yeah, I kept thinking back to the Presley marriage and how,
oh my God,
I forget that it happened, and whenever reminded, I shudder, and then I forget again. I think it's just a defense mechanism on my brain's part. It's like, don't remember this. It's better.
Yeah. And he slept in an oxygen chamber for a while. I mean, there are so many strange details about his life once he kind of like made it and was quote unquote independent. And then also a lot of like very disturbing, somewhat tragic details about his childhood that, you know, again, going through archival stories, you can find a lot about that, and also just kind of the way it was contextualized at the time, and then kind of thinking about knowing what we know now and where he might have learned some of the manipulation tactics that he used.
Yeah. Untouchable posits that a lot of these tabloid stories, like the hyperbaric chamber and some of the weird shit about the chimp, he leaked these details to the press and like encouraged these stories to be written, which is like, I think if we haven't, like, we didn't assign enough blame to Michael Jackson for his predatory tendencies, and we also may not have given him enough credit, quote unquote, for being a master of his own image, even if we didn't understand why he would want it to be in that shape.
Yes.
He was much more in control of everything than we thought, to disastrous effect for some
kids.
That's right.
I mean, just that was eye-opening in the documentary when you see the Lisa Marie marriage kind of coincide with him still abusing these young men at that point. Or were they still boys? And that Michael Jackson – no, they were still boys. And Michael Jackson contacting one of them and saying, I'm going to have to probably get married at some point publicly.
Yes. Yeah.
Just like, oh.
To get them off our backs. Okay.
Yep. And the we-ness of it too. That was the other thing that really struck me, of like how manipulative his whole, like, we're in this together. You know, we need to stand up against them, as if, you know, he was a team with these vulnerable children.
Yeah.
So,
and if it comes out, we will both go to jail. Like,
that's right.
That's not how it works.
Criminal.
Ugh. All right. Well, Piper, thank you for coming back for the Blotter Presents hat trick and braving this important but wrenching material. Where else can listeners find your work?
They can find my memoir, You All Grow Up and Leave Me, which grapples with some of these issues, which it's part true crime, part memoir about a child predator in the 90s. So there's a little overlap there. And I am on Instagram at Piper Weiss and Twitter at The Piper Weiss.
The cold case section today is something a little different, although the subject matter is not unrelated. The documentary Abducted in Plain Sight was the ubiquitous true crime doc topic earlier in the year. That's the story of Jan Broberg, kidnapped and assaulted by the same family friend twice, and how the man who kidnapped her, Robert Birchtold, successfully preyed on not only teenage Jan, but also her parents in order to get what he wanted. Abducted in Plain Sight raises similar questions to Leaving Neverlands about parental responsibility, predatory grooming, warped affections, how religious faith provides a cover for monsters, and the lasting effects on the children who survive these, quote, relationships. I talked to Abducted in Plain Sight's director, Skye Borgman, a couple weeks ago about some of these issues, plus how she came to this project and her documentary film inspirations. Thank you again for making the time to do this, especially with the movie blowing up the way it has been the last couple of weeks or months. Did you expect that that would happen once it hit streaming, or you didn't know?
I didn't really know. I mean, obviously, I hoped it would happen. I know from the reactions that we've gotten from people watching it, they've always been very strong reactions. So I think I was hoping for it. I don't know if I expected quite this much of a reaction, but it's just so exciting, really, to know that people are really responding to the film.
Right. Let us back up a little bit to how you came to this story. You've said that you discovered it by reading the Broberg's book and that your producer brought it to you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they had self-published the book, Stolen Innocence, the Jan Broberg story, in the early 2000s. And this was really meant as kind of a companion piece for Jan speaking at child abuse foundations and in different groups about her story. And it also came about because Jan was trying to piece things together, and she approached her mom and had been told by someone, well, maybe you should try to write this down and figure out, you know, just kind of put the pieces together. And so there were some big gaps to her, and she approached her mom and said, let's write this book together. And so they wrote it. It took a few years to do that. And self-published. They never were able to get a publisher on board. I don't really even know how hard they tried to get a publisher on board, that they were thinking about that.
Right.
But so Stephanie, one of the producers, had, and Jan share a mutual friend. And they were talking about the Ariel Castro case when the girls escaped. And the mutual friend said, well, if you think that story's crazy, you should read this book, and handed it to Stephanie. And Stephanie read it and was just completely shocked by it and couldn't believe this had happened and wanted to tell this story and do something. So that's when she approached me to see if I'd come on board and produce and direct the film.
So had you been looking for something to do a documentary feature on anyway, or was this more of a thing where the circumstances in the book told you this is what you're doing?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, really. I've directed a feature documentary before called Junk Dreams, and it's a very different documentary. It's a family story, really, about my father and I sailing a Chinese junk boat up the Alaskan coast. And I work as a director of photography, and I shoot a lot of documentary films, and I love them. And I know how hard it is and how much time it takes to get one done.
Sure.
And there'd been a few times where some ideas had come up or something, and I just wasn't quite sure I would be able to commit myself for the 5 years it takes, or the 3 years it takes, or the 7 years it takes
right.
to finish one of these on an independent timeline. And when this one came along, I just felt like this was the one. So I was kind of looking, but it was also just the fact that it came along, and I just couldn't understand really how something like this could happen. And I was intrigued.
So have you been attracted? It doesn't look, based on your CV, like true crime is necessarily your lane or has been your lane. Is that a genre that you've been attracted to at all? Or again, this was just sort of this story presented itself versus the genre?
Yeah, I think it was this story that presented itself. And it's funny because at the beginning, I didn't really even know it was true crime.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't have labeled that. And I kind of learned that as we went along and as we did more sort of investigative work and figuring out how these pieces went together and what had happened. So I think I've always loved watching true crime. But I think I've kind of found a love of this genre now through this film. But before, I hadn't really focused on true crime. I'd always wanted to just travel and shoot beautiful things, you know?
Right. And true crime doesn't necessarily,
no.
doesn't necessarily qualify. I think I want to get back to part of that later, but my next question was about the LDS church aspect of the Brobergs story. You told Vanity Fair that you would have liked to get more into that aspect of things. Were there other issues like that that you didn't press because they felt like they were going to turn into their own separate documentaries, perhaps? Because that was the impression I got based on your comments to Vanity Fair about their, you know, faith, that you felt like that was a whole separate story, maybe.
Yeah. Well, and we tried, you know, there were so many times where my editor, James Coode, and I, would really say, okay, let's get into this faith a little bit more. And so we'd spend a week or two, you know, editing these whole chunks together. And it was this rabbit hole, really, you know, It just turned into this whole other film. And so we'd steer it back to the Broberg story, and then it would go off on a different tangent. So, I mean, we were lucky in a sense because there was no clock ticking. And so we had the time to explore a lot of different avenues with the film. But I really do, I love the film that we ended up with. I mean, I really love the film. There's part of me that goes, I really wish we'd been able to delve into the LDS within this film. But then there's another part of me that I know that it would have just been a completely different story. So I'm certainly interested in looking at that a little bit more. And again, it's not even just LDS faith, but I think it's honestly really patriarchal institutions that, you know, and the cover-ups that happen. I mean, if we look around us right now, we're seeing it left and right. And so that to me is a very fascinating topic. And I'd love to dive into that. And I don't know if it's necessarily, you know, a sequel per se to this film, but to look at these ideas maybe with different within different contexts and other stories.
Sure. And there's the fact that this was occurring, you know, decades ago, when I think our understanding of predators, of serial killers, of harm of this type was just a nub compared to what we take for granted now about instincts and stuff like that. There's been a lot of discussion among the true crime commentariat in the last month or so around responsibility to victims in a feature or series that's in the true crime genre. It's been primarily around the Ted Bundy series on Netflix. Of course, you've had this movie in the can for a couple of years now at this point. But was this something that was on your mind as you were shooting and editing the piece? Where was the line with exploiting the people who are on camera?
Yes. I mean, it's always on your mind, especially, I think, when you're dealing with sexual abuse. And especially, I think, as a woman, too, it's something that I was constantly asking myself. And I was also worried, I think, at every moment, you know, that I was losing perspective. And it's hard when you're editing a documentary and when you're putting all these stories together, you know, you get so involved. And so that perspective is critical to be able to get it back or maintain it. And so I did find that it was really helpful for me to screen the film with other people, with like small audiences in my living room, and get how they were feeling about what they were experiencing on the TV. And so that was helpful. And I do remember at pretty much every one of those screenings, and we did, you know, 15 or 20 of them, how it was a question that was at the forefront of my mind every time, you know, are we victim blaming? And there were times, honestly, in various different versions of the cut where we maybe were crossing that line a little bit and we had to pull that back. And so it's such an interesting question. It's a vital question, I think, but it was something that we were asking ourselves all the time.
Sure. You've also talked in other interviews about taking a break for 5 or 6 weeks to just sort of reset yourself with the material. Yeah. And I think you specifically mentioned feeling this frustration with the parents and needing to step back from that. Were there other perspective issues, for lack of a better term, that you used that time to reset on, like the victim blaming?
Yeah, all of it. And even to an extent, I think it was at that time where we'd never really had an ending to the film at that point. We just couldn't get our head wrapped around it. And it was during that 6 weeks where, I mean, I for the most part stepped away from it, but I was constantly, you know, laying in bed awake in the middle of the night, sort of thinking, you know, what is it that we're missing? And I realized that we hadn't really had much of Jan's voice in the end of the film. And you see in the film, you know, when she comes back and, you know, 28 years later, it's a completely different interview. It was shot in January of 2017, you know, and we got it out in the world in May of 2017. So it was that I felt like everybody was sort of talking about Jan, and I literally lying in bed at night was like, I've got to do another interview with Jan and I need her voice in the end of this film. And it was so great because it was just Jan and I. I mean, I called her, I said, come over. I'd just like to do one final interview with you. And it was just this very intimate, wonderful thing. And where I really was able to get her perspective and her voice on where she was and how she was feeling about the whole thing. Because at that point, you know, I'd shown her a cut of it and she was very invested and very interested in telling us how her healing was and how much she loved her parents and how, and the, a lot of guilt too that she carries around for, I think, putting her parents through this documentary and for feeling the need to talk about it. I mean, her parents want to talk about it too, but I think Jan carries a bit of guilt around for that too. So yeah, it helped me a lot to be able to do that last interview with Jan.
Mm-hmm. As a cinematographer, which is your widest lane on IMDb anyway, as you know, if you've consumed any kind of nonfiction programming, but particularly in the true crime space, reenactments can get kind of dicey.
Yes.
Especially with some of the more cynically minded shows like Wives with Knives. And particularly in subject matter like this, where what you're recreating is an assault on a child. Can you talk a little bit about the decision to do those and sort of structurally and emotionally, and what were the challenges involved in shooting those, at least like the actors in the sequences, for example?
Yeah. I mean, I think first and foremost, the challenges to recreations are sort of landing on a stylistic choice that suits the story.
Mm-hmm.
And also in my mind, and I think we were mostly successful with this, but there are still, you know, I watch it back and there are still shots that I go, I would have loved to figure out a different way to do that, you know? But I think what you're really trying to do is convey the emotion of what's going on and not necessarily, the action of what's going on. You know,
right.
the last thing I really want to do is kind of say, you know, X happened and then you're seeing X happen on screen.
Right.
So I'd much rather get deeper with the recreations and get to the emotion of what's happening. Like, I think in the film, really, my favorite shot is the shot of the leaves on the trees through the top of the motorhome, you know, because it's very, it's emotional, it's suggestive, but it's also very simple.
Mm.
So I did with the recreations, we shot them all on 8mm film. And I mean, there were a couple of conversations really that we had in terms of style. And I felt that it was important to try to transport people back in time, because I do think the time is an important factor of this story, that it was in the 70s. And I also wanted people to be able to see a little girl and to understand that this was happening to a little girl, because, you know, you do an interview with Jan and she's this gorgeous woman, adult woman who's confident and has this strong voice. And it could be hard potentially to imagine her as a little girl. And so I wanted to be able to see a little girl in these recreations. And so, and I also wanted them, I mean, I've, you know, the recreations have been very, in some films, they really take you out. And I wanted the recreations to kind of transport you back. So that's how the style of the recreations happened. And then in terms of kind of the content of the recreations, it was, we were constantly going back and forth a little bit. We would edit the interviews and then we would cut in recreations, or I would go shoot the recreations and then bring them in. And so it wasn't that we had everything sort of lined up and locked and then I went and shot the recreations, because they were kind of important to how the story was being edited. So we would edit and shoot some and edit and shoot some and edit and shoot some. So they became critical in sort of crafting that story as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I watch a lot of this kind of material, and for me, at least, reenactments are often like umpires watching a baseball game. Like, the best thing you can say is that you didn't notice them. But so that's sort of like the bar for me. But I did think these were very successful in evoking the time without either duplicating what you're already hearing or pulling you out of it to that extent. So, yeah. The leaves in particular, that sequence was...
I know it sticks with you. I had a friend, actually, one of the first people who watched a cut of the film where we had some recreations in there. And she had said, she goes, I feel a little bit manipulated by these recreations. And I was like, oh, really? And she goes, yeah, because I'm having a hard time seeing the difference between the actual home movies and the recreations. Mm. And then she had said, do you want to do something like, you know, say these are recreations and this is real home movie? And I was like, oh my God, that's just going to get so cumbersome to do that, to sort of, you know, put a little title card or lower thirds on everything. And then the more I thought, and I think her statement was completely valid. And the more I thought about it, the more I kind of was leaning into this idea of blurring the lines between reality and what we're creating.
Right.
And I kind of got to this point where I was like, well, maybe this is what Berchtold was doing a little bit. Like, you never really know what's the truth, and you never really know what's fiction, and you can glean what we're creating as recreations and what's real, but you kind of have to constantly be questioning that. And it's definitely like a very, you know, hidden kind of thing, but it was what I was thinking as I was going through these recreations and having them look so much like the home movies. Like, maybe I'll lean into this blurring of what's real and what's not real, because I think that's what the Brobergs were going through in a massive way.
Yeah, for sure. And particularly that they were home movies. And mm-hmm. So then you're sort of like reflecting stylistically, where is the safe space?
Right. Yeah. I don't think that comes across at all in the movie. I mean, that's sort of like, you know, filmmaker mumbo jumbo, I guess.
Hey, I'm here for it.
Thank you.
I sign off on that.
Okay.
You're probably just about done talking about that hand job, so I'm not going to go there. But is there anything that you wish that people would ask you about in interviews about the film that they're not, or we are not touching on?
Well, it is, you know, it is very interesting, because I think that people have really, really talked a lot about the parents and their role in Jan's abduction. And what's curious to me is people aren't talking about Jan that much and her sisters, and especially Jan, because she is this film, and she's the one that sort of got through this and has this incredible capacity for forgiveness, and her sisters as well. I mean, the simple fact that the entire family was willing really to go on camera and bring this all back to the surface again, yeah, is astounding to me. And that they're not, look, it's hard for them right now because they're getting a lot of backlash, but I think they also expected it. And the fact that they're willing to really go out and tell their story is just, it's pretty incredible to me.
Yeah. I think there's possibly a whole other film, or like a shadow narrative, to be made about the sisters,
and I know
sort of what they're going through with this Jan-shaped hole in the house at various times.
Yeah. Well, I think it's this Jan-shaped hole, and then it's also this idea that, you know, that Jan went through this horrible thing when they were kids, and so, I don't know, like, they can never be mad at her. And look, I know that they're mad at her. I know there's plenty of times when they get mad at her. But it's almost like, I know that I talked to Karen at some point, and she just talked about how Jan, because of who Jan is and because of what happened in a way too, is always going to get the spotlight. And I think there's just, you know, when you think of these sister relationships or sibling relationships, and who's the most popular, or who gets the attention, or who does this, who's the smartest, who's the best looking, you know, those are always things I think that people think about, and just how that affects all of the sisters. And they, look, they're such a happy family. They love each other so much. But I know, especially with Karen, she feels a lot of that Jan always gets the attention. And whenever she was kind of at this point where she should be getting the attention, it somehow always shifted over to Jan. And that's something she's felt, I think, her entire life.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm just sort of dying to see the follow-up documentary about the sisters, because I feel like the families, like the ripple effects of crime, know, just takes all these things that we believe about sibling order and family of origin roles and just magnifies them to this almost difficult to look at degree. All right. Well, I think that's about all I have, but I usually wrap these interviews up by asking about your foundational or key true crime properties that inspired you. If we can sort of go camera, if you'd rather, especially with the Oscars trying to boot all the Craft Awards off of being broadcast. So
isn't it amazing that they listened? I mean, that, like, I sit there going, first of all, it was just one mess up after another with the Oscars.
Oh, yeah.
And now, And now it's just like, you know, everybody said, this is crazy. No, we're not standing for it. And they're like, okay. You know, and I just sit there going, you just don't. I mean, like, come on.
What are you, like a cinematography? It's right there on the tin.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, and in terms of true crime films, I mean, there's been some really wonderful ones. I mean, I think one of the ones I hearken back to a lot in making Abducted in Plain Sight was The Imposter. I thought The Imposter was just really
adore that movie, which is a weird thing to say about given the subject matter, but it's so good.
Yeah. But that and Capturing the Freedmans, really. I mean, two of my all time favorites. Although I have to admit, I just watched Won't You Be My Neighbor? Yeah, a couple of days ago. I was sort of late to the game in getting to that one, and not at all true crime, but I loved it so much. So I'm going back to the Oscars. I think it's a crime that it wasn't nominated for Best Documentary. I think it's just wonderful.
Yeah, agree. Yeah. That one and
Three Identical Strangers. Yes. Yeah, incredible.
That is still with me. I watched it 3 months ago, and I'm shocked that wasn't nominated.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. The film really was stunning. Like, literally, we were stunned watching it. So congratulations. It's really sustaining as something that people are thinking about and talking about. So well done.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Eve Beatty on Adnan Syed. Stephanie Green makes it a Theranos hat trick with HBO's The Inventor, and yet more Gypsy Blanchard with Hulu's The Act. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? Find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. Email me at bunting@the-blotter.com or become an official Blotter tipster at The Blotter's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. Like the podcast? Tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. Don't like the podcast? Keep it to yourself. My guest was Piper Weiss, and she's on Twitter @ThePiperWeiss. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.